Hello, I'm Ian. Welcome to Creator Coco. This podcast helps you become a better creator by helping you learn from what other creators have already figured out. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us a tweet at Creator Coco. That's creator and then C-O-C-O-A. In this episode, we talk about some of the books I'm reading, Steal Like an Artist, The Art of Seduction, and AI Superpowers. I hope you learn something that helps you become a better creator. This episode was brought to you by Fictionista. Fictionista is an app for writing, where new sentences, storylines, and characters can be magically suggested to you as you write, using the power of artificial intelligence. With Fictionista, it's easier than ever to create new worlds and write that story you've always wanted to write. No more writer's block. You can download Fictionista from the App Store or the Play Store, or go to Fictionista.club. That's Fictionista.club. So today we're here to talk about some of the books that we have been reading recently and also go through some of the lessons we've learned. Books are something that I think are very important and they hold a lot of knowledge, and a lot of people don't read as much as they should. But if you're listening to this and you feel like your reading habits could be improved, or reading is not a habit that you do daily, I would highly recommend that you try and pick it up. You can always start with things which you're interested in, things like, you know, if you like, if there's a kind of a fiction book you like or something you've always wanted to read. Nowadays, you can always find books easily via free PDFs online, and some even come by default on your phone. And also there are cheap books maybe that you can buy either online or some even in the real world, or you can ask your friends to share with you a book that they liked reading. But it's always a good habit for you to get into, because the truth is a lot of very, very powerful ideas are hidden inside books. These are not things you can get by watching a YouTube video. It's not something you can get by reading a blog. Sometimes reading a book is the only way for you to get this kind of information. And when I say book, I don't necessarily mean like sitting down and reading a physical book or reading a bunch of text. You can always use even some kinds of podcasts. You can also use audiobooks like on Audible, which is something I recommend if you can afford Audible. It's a very good service and it has a lot of books. But yeah, get into the habit of reading books. It's amazing and you're going to learn a lot. It's changed my life. I've learned so many things that I would not have learned otherwise. And so today I'm going to go through three books, which I think I've read in the past and I think are interesting. And I'm just going to share some of the lessons which I've learned in those books. You can check them out for yourselves. These ones specifically I got on Audible, but you can also get the physical copies as well if you have the chance. So the first book is called Steal Like an Artist by Austin Kleon. And it's basically a book, like it's basically in the title. It's for artists and for people who want to be creative, if you want to express your creativity. A lot of us find ourselves limited in our creativity by issues, psychological issues that you find in your brain. And Steal Like an Artist kind of helps you break down a few of the assumptions that you're making, which can prevent you from fully expressing yourself, or which prevent you from being the best artist that you can be. And one of them is coming up with your own style. Sometimes when you're thinking of coming up with something or trying to come up with an idea for a new piece of art, this could be a YouTube video, it could be music, it could be a piece of art, it could be pretty much anything, even software applications or anything you feel will adequately express who you are and the kinds of talents that you want to bring out into the world. So how do you find your own style and how do you start creating? And one point that is made here, and that's actually in the title of the book, is that it's important to try and imitate others to some degree if you're not sure about what your style is. And a lot of times when you're feeling like you're imitating, you're like, am I copying this person? Am I stealing from them? Am I guilty? And here there's a difference between copying something exactly for the sake of copying or trying to imitate that style. And what happens is when you try to imitate someone else, because you can't exactly implement the thing the same way that they did, you're going to end up creating something that is slightly different. And the difference between what you wanted to make and what you ended up making, that ends up being your own style. So you'll find your own style where you fail to imitate your idols. If you're trying to make something that copies someone else and you're doing it in a genuine way, you're trying to imitate someone else. Maybe you like someone's music and you're trying to make music like that. If you're being genuine and you work hard at it and you're actually trying to make something good, you will end up making something that is different. It is inspired by, but it's going to be distinctively you. And this is a process I have experienced myself. You can start by wanting to copy someone, but then you end up creating something that is, first of all, completely different, completely distinct. It's its own thing. And it's something that's only you could have made because, you know, you're you. And it brings me back to this quote, which is that the only thing that is original is your taste. So a lot of times you want to be original. You want to create something new. And I believe it's still possible to do that in spite of where we currently are with all the stuff that's already been made, all the artists who have existed. It's still possible for you to be original. But that originality comes from your own taste. It doesn't come from, you know, you using, a unique kind of, you can't create something unique, definitely, I think, still. But it comes from your own taste, like who you are and the kind of taste you have. And sometimes I also go through the process of embracing mistakes. Because when you think about it, a lot of the times when you make a mistake, you decide to, you know, either erase it or try and redo it again. But sometimes originality comes through doing things which you did not intend to do, and it ends up being something new and something interesting. A lot of scientific discoveries, a lot of medicines, a lot of new art were discovered through mistakes. And even I feel like that's how AI works. AI works by making way more mistakes than any human being could possibly make. And out of those mistakes, it discovers new things that human beings would not have discovered. Usually, as human beings, we think of this is a specific way to draw a face. This is a specific way to build software. This is a specific way to make music. But it's also possible in that process, if you make a mistake, leave the mistake there. And that mistake could be considered a new way of doing things. Because a mistake, like who decides what a mistake is? You know, some of the things we do today were considered mistakes in the past, you know. So try to imitate, don't try to copy. And also don't wait until you know who you are to get started. This is a huge issue that a lot of artists usually face if you're trying to get started with something. You decide that it's much more important for you to sit down and think and figure things out and plan your life and get things in the perfect, you know, like where you understand your life perfectly and things are just right for you to be able to proceed and move on with your creativity. But that's a misconception. And it's just your internal resistance preventing you from moving on. When you're thinking of doing something, when you feel like, if I do this, I will feel good. But then you also at the same time get that feeling of anxiety that you actually have to take your first step. And you decide to step back instead of to push forward in spite of your anxiety, in spite of the fears that you have. It's very important for you to not wait. If you're interested in doing something, start. Your first few tries might not work. And that's the thing. At least the way I look at things, there's no such thing as a failure or a success or anything like that. It's just that you're trying to do something. And did you achieve it according to the standards that you set? If you're beginning, it's important to have low standards, or it's important to just do it out of curiosity, or to do it in the bare minimum way. In software, sometimes it's called the minimum viable product. Like you just do the bare minimum. Like if you're trying to, for example, learn how to draw a face or something like that, or to paint something, you just do the laziest painting that you possibly can do. And then you look at the results and then you're like, I achieved the result. I know it's not the best painting, but I achieved something. And then you can build on top of that, because now you can start considering yourself an artist because you actually have work that you've done, instead of waiting and trying to figure out your life before you get started. And a lot of us also have jobs, like you're doing 9-to-5 jobs, like you're basically tied to the man and to the machine and in the rat race. And even if you're not, it's important for you to have side projects. It's important for you to have hobbies. It's important for you to find other ways for you to express yourself apart from the work that you do. Because a lot of the times, even the maybe you came out of high school, then you selected some kind of a course that you did in university, and then afterwards you went through a job. A lot of times that pipeline, when you think about it, the pipeline of education that we send children through is a pipeline that's predetermined in order to create laborers for the employers to have people to fill up their positions. Like the reason why there's a certain degree is so that the people who do that degree can go and work for a specific company. And it's not because those people actually wanted to do that degree. It's because there's a specific industry that needs people who fill that kind of position. And a lot of these positions don't match with our own internal desires. And so how you start a side business, how you start discovering yourself, how you leave that kind of mentality is by exploring your own inclinations in your own free time. This is very important because otherwise you're not going to know what you're capable of. And so that's why it's very important to organize your free time in a way that lets you become creative. Try to not use it to, consume, things like, I don't know, movies, Netflix, all of that stuff. Of course, you can make time for that stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's also another side of free time, which is creativity and being able to use it to express yourself. And it's a very beautiful thing to be able to start realizing the kinds of talents that you have. If there are things that you wanted to do as a child that you weren't able to figure out, or you had dreams and talents that you had as a child, but because of life, you ended up veering away from those inclinations that you had. That free time is a time for you to now start rediscovering even the things you wanted to do as a child, and as much and even add on top of them to find new interesting things that as an adult now you're also interested in. So side projects and hobbies are important to express yourself. And the other point that the book makes is that geography is no longer our master. So we have the internet nowadays. And with the internet, it's possible for you, as you're making your art, it's now easier than ever to share your art. In the past, whenever you made art, you had to find, I don't know, sponsors, you had to find galleries, you had to find, I don't know, it was a much more difficult process to get people to actually engage with you. But now you can start blogs, you can start groups, you can start communities, you can start like making content around your own art. And it's much easier to share. So if you think about the ease of being able to express yourself nowadays, it's way more than most people in history have ever had. Just because you have a smartphone, it allows you to do way more than most people have ever been able to do in their whole lives. So you should realize that and start taking advantage of the internet. And these side hobbies that you have, a lot of them, you can find your audience and your niches online. It might take time. People might not engage with you at all. Maybe people might actively dislike what you're doing, but that's part of the process of being an artist. Sometimes you can, linger in obscurity. Sometimes you can be famous, but it's much easier to become famous nowadays or to find the people who you're looking for nowadays than it has ever been. So you should realize that it's a very huge gift and it's also a responsibility, and you shouldn't waste it. Social media is there for you to use. And for it not to use you, you have to make sure you're not spending too much time on social media as well. And this brings me to the last point of the book. Okay, it's not the last point of the book, but the last point I want to address in the book, which is the idea of being a boring, ordinary, and regular person in your life. Like organizing your life in a way that you are just the most boring person. Like, you're waking up on time, you are sleeping on time, you're doing everything that you wanted to do every day on time. you're not, you know, there's nothing wrong with partying. There's nothing wrong with hanging out with friends. There's nothing wrong with going out and traveling and doing a lot of stuff. And all of that stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's a certain advantage that comes with a boring life, which means all the excitement that you want to, you know, that you want to feel, you express it through the work that you do. So because your time has been taken care of, and time is the most important asset that you have, I know that's a cliche, but it's extremely true. And it's something all of us should realize. Like, your 24 hours are extremely important, and you can draw so much value from them if you organize them well. So after you've organized them and you're living a boring life, when you sit down and when you work, that's when the excitement, that's when the violence and originality comes in. That's where the energy, that's where the energy comes out, where through the kinds of hobbies that you're doing, how you're expressing yourself, the kinds of, you know, you put in the energy of, you know, the excitement that you would have gotten otherwise into the kind of work that you're doing. And that's how you make the best work, because you're now focused on being keen, paying attention, trying exciting new things, and that's pretty much how you're going to succeed, and that's how you're going to feel you're going to feel best by creating. So it's a book called Steal Like an Artist. It's not very long actually, and but it has some good ideas, and you can check it out. Just be free to look around you, and if you like an idea, try to imitate it, and through that imitation, you're going to find yourself. You're going to find the mistakes. You're going to find the interesting nuances of your own personality that can end up being called original by people who don't understand the kinds of sources or the kinds of references that you are using when you are creating the art. The next book is called The Art of Seduction by Robert Greene. I am a huge fan of Robert Greene. He is an amazing writer, and he has some brilliant ideas, and I believe he has changed the lives of so many people. He has a few other books apart from Art of Seduction. He has one which is super famous called The 48 Laws of Power. He has The 48 Laws of Power. He also has The Laws of Human Nature. He also has, I think the laws of war or something like that, the art of war, something like that. But he basically writes about the human condition and the rules of society and the psychological games that people are playing with each other. And it kind of helps you understand in a deeper way, and also with examples, things that are not very obvious if you're interacting with people. And this can apply to your relationships with other human beings. Maybe if you're working in an office, maybe you're in a business, maybe even in your own family. One thing I recommend is do not try and apply some of these things necessarily to like your closest friends. Like don't try and apply the 48 laws of power to your relationship with your girlfriend. That's basically don't take it that seriously. Some of these are just mostly for politicians, for businessmen, and just know when to apply it. They don't apply everywhere, and they're not like laws which, you know, it's not like the laws of physics that you have to obey them. They're just interesting rules and interesting anecdotes for you to pay attention to, and some of them even contradict each other. So it's up to you to decide when you're going to use one, or when one is a good example for you to follow at a specific time. They can also help you in retrospect to understand some of the mistakes that you've been making in your life. If you are trying something and it did not work out because other people reacted in a way that you did not anticipate, then these books can also give you a retrospective and help you understand, oh, what could I have done better? What kind of social mistakes did I make? And how can I improve going forward so that I can influence other people in better ways, and also understand how they're trying to influence me so I can be more aware of the kinds of actions that I'm taking. Sometimes you feel like you're completely in control of your mind, but the truth is, it's usually not that obvious. It's not that clear, and sometimes other people can take advantage of you. So this one is called the Art of Seduction, and it basically says that the seduction is a game of psychology. It's not a game of beauty. A lot of times when you're trying to seduce someone else, which means you are. So to seduce someone is to entice someone into possibly sexual activity, or entice someone to believe something or to attract them in a powerful way. So a lot of humanity, a lot of the things we do revolve around seducing other people. If you look at popular media, if you look at pop culture, if you look at the kinds of music videos people are making, if you look at Instagram, pretty much it's the whole thing is a seduction game. People are trying to seduce you to make you more attracted to them. And what this book is trying to say is that seduction is more than what you're going to see. It's not just a game of are you beautiful or not. You can find that someone is not the most beautiful person, but they are good at seducing women or men. And a point that is made is that the number one way to be seductive is to be unpredictable. People don't like as soon as you figure something out, you figure someone out, you understand the kinds of moves that they're making, you understand their moods, and you understand their wants. If someone doesn't have any mystery, then it's easy to start taking advantage of them because you can see where they're going, you can understand their actions easily. But if someone is unpredictable and someone is mysterious, you can now it becomes something more exciting and becomes a puzzle for you to solve, and you're curious about what is going on behind the mask. And also, when it comes to that of seduction, I don't you shouldn't take some of these things too literally. Partly, I'm reading it for entertainment, and I also read it for just general knowledge. It's not something like as soon as you read it, you start taking down notes and you start putting this stuff in action. This is just stuff you should have at the back of your mind in a general sense. I don't believe you should necessarily start acting on some of this stuff, because even a lot of the examples that Robert Greene provides are examples from like the 1800s and the 1500s and stuff. So there are a lot of them are not applicable to the world we live in today. Everything has changed. And so he goes into defining the kinds of seducers. So you as someone who wants to seduce, like if you're a man and you want to seduce a woman, or if you're a woman, I usually it's the okay, it's actually, you'll find that seduction works both ways. There are women who are extremely good at seducing, and there are also men who are extremely good at seducing. So seduction is it's a two-way thing, as much as you would find that it's men who always have to chase the women, but women are also always positioning themselves in a position for them to be seduced, and they're also positioning themselves in a way to seduce other people. And there are a lot of examples of women who are very good at seducing. There's women who pretty much live off seducing men, and that's how they make their money. And the book talks about nine types of seducers. So I won't go into details, but I'll just name the nine types. And from these titles, you'll try and figure out for yourself what these mean. But you can also read the book to learn more. So there's the siren, the rake, the ideal lover, the dandy, the natural, the coquette, the charmer, the charismatic, and the star. So he basically goes into an explanation of nine different types of ways that people try to seduce other people, or the nine different kinds of people. And as an individual, you can be multiple types of seducers. Like you can be a rake and you can also be a siren. Like you can be someone who's an ideal lover, and you can also be someone who is charming. You can be someone who wants attention, and you can also be someone who is like you can be a mix of different kinds of things. And this is just to give you an idea of how different people try to appeal to other people. And the other important thing that this book also gives you is trying to spot anti-seductive behaviors. So apart from wanting to seduce someone, you can also inadvertently come off as anti-seductive. Sometimes the things you think are seductive for someone else are not as seductive as you thought they were, and they end up pushing that person away instead of bringing them closer to you. So it's important for you to also learn about who you are yourself, and the kinds of flaws that you have, and you also want to get rid of them over time. And some of these are, and these ones also have names, but I'm now going to be a bit more specific. So one thing is being too blunt. Sometimes you are interested in a woman or a man, and you just wanna get your words out there. You just wanna be super obvious and just be like, yo, this is the deal. But sometimes that might push people off. But ironically, in other situations, maybe other people like that. So it's up to you to determine who is this other person, and is it important for me to be blunt right now? Or should I, even at different stages of the relationship, sometimes what she wants is for you to be blunt. But sometimes, if especially in the beginning of a relationship, I don't think it's a good idea to be too blunt. You just kind of want to be chill and play the game. There's also the idea of drowning the other person in affection. Sometimes some people like affection, but sometimes you'll find that maybe someone likes someone else, and you just start immediately drowning them in affection, telling them how much you love them, how much they mean to you, how much all this, you want to get married, you want to have their babies, and that can push people away as well. Because some people are just not in that stage at that time to be able to accept that those kinds of advances, and it might come off as desperate, or you're trying too hard or clingy. But then at the same time, some people like being clinged on, so some of these things, it depends on the situation. Then there's the not being able to take a joke, because you're trying too hard to make the other person like you. So like you can't, like you're taking things too seriously, and you need to be able to, sometimes relax, see things as humorous, or see things as, don't take everything too seriously. Also, people who talk too much, and this one, I don't think there's a, like, in general, it's good to be someone who can listen. But so if you're talking too much, usually about yourself, it's kind of a sign of weakness. Yeah, like if you're having a conversation with someone and you're not paying attention, I mean, there's like right now I'm talking, but if I was having a conversation with someone, it's important to be able to also take time to listen to what the other person is saying, and respond to them appropriately instead of just being able just talking about yourself or trying to praise the other person too much or something like that. There's also the idea of being too insecure. Sometimes, like, we all have insecurities. I have my insecurities. I'm sure you have your insecurities. The thing is, a lot of, like, no one else cares about the insecurities I have, and no one else, like, I don't necessarily care about the insecurities you have, and I'm sure that other people around you probably don't care about the insecurities that you have because they don't know what those insecurities are. Usually, if you're confident with yourself and you just move in a confident way, and that's how you appear, no one is going to see the kinds of insecurities that you have. A lot of movie stars and a lot of famous people have insecurities, but if you look at them, it's not really possible to understand why they would be insecure about such a thing. But sometimes that kind of insecurity can hold you back. If you're still in a stage of your life where you have not been able to move past those insecurities and they're still holding you back, other people are going to notice, and it's going to start to affect how they're going to perceive you, because you're going to be shy, and you're not gonna want to engage in specific ways, and you're not gonna be able to have fun in certain ways because you're insecure, when in reality, it's just a mental block that you have for yourself. And the other people don't necessarily care that much as you, but you, because of your insecurities, it ends up affecting you. The other thing that's anti-seductive is complaining all the time. Like, you don't want to be with someone who is constantly negative. If you've gone to a restaurant or something, or if you're just living life, or if you're just experiencing stuff and the other person is, being negative or complaining a lot, that can also make you feel negative, and people don't usually want to be around people like that. And so yeah, think about that. And a lot of these are mistakes I have also made in the past, but this is just to help you understand why some of these things happen. We all make mistakes. I'll probably still continue to make some of these mistakes in the future. The next one is wanting too much from the other person, which is like you're too overbearing, and you're too demanding, and you're not patient, and you're just asking them for a lot. That can usually also push people away. And yeah, it's important to think about how do you seduce the other person. And in this book, there's a lot of good examples. He tells a lot of stories about women and men in the past who seduce, who try and seduce other people. And he shows you the kinds of stories and the kinds of anecdotes and the kinds of things that people do to end up seducing the people that they want to get interested in. And you can learn some of these strategies. You can learn some of these tactics. Again, I don't think this is a practical book. Like, don't go and try to necessarily implement some of these things in your life immediately, like a rule book. It's just to know in which situation should you, you know, consider your actions more thoughtfully, and how can you use this knowledge to inform the decisions that you make when you're interacting with people. So seduction is a game of psychology. It's not a game of beauty. You don't need to be the most beautiful person to be the most seductive person. And I'm sure deep down, you can kind of feel that that is true. Because if you look at the kinds of men and women who end up matching up, it's not necessarily a game of who is more seductive than the other person. Sorry, who is more beautiful than the other person? There are people who are not that beautiful matching up with people who are beautiful. A lot of times, money has a role to play in that, where you find rich guys end up having, you know, if you're rich and you're not that attractive, maybe the money makes you more attractive. And I don't see anything wrong with that. Like, the same way beauty can make someone more attractive, if money can make someone more attractive, it's also a superficial thing that people use. But there's also situations where people have money in general. Like, let's say you have 10 guys and they all are rich. How does a woman make a decision among all those 10 people? It's going to come down to how seductive the other people are, if they're all equally good looking as well. The third book I'll be talking about today is called AI Superpowers by Kai-Fu Lee. So AI Superpowers is a book that aims to help you understand what to expect of the effect of AI on the future of the economy and also the future job opportunities. AI is something that is now coming into our consciousness because a lot of this knowledge was actually discovered or already planned out in probably the 1950s to the 1980s. But because of our lack of computer resources, like, we didn't have enough storage, we didn't have enough data, AI was still in its infancy. And you can argue that even now it's still in its infancy, but it's becoming more accessible and it's becoming more useful. So this is an important conversation to have. And this AI Superpowers just analyzes the global kind of idea of AI and what are different countries doing, especially the US and China. And how is that battle going on right now? And what do we expect in the future? Kai-Fu Lee also wrote a book called AI 2041, which is it's kind of a book that explains in stories what you should expect. So it's much more story-driven. Like, it's much easier to read. Like, even, I feel like even... It kind of tends towards being a children's book in some situations, which is something I did not personally like about it, but I like the idea of explaining how AI might be in the year of 2041 through stories which involve people. So you can actually see use cases. You can see, oh, this is someone in Nigeria. This is how AI is going to be affecting them. This is someone in the US. This is how AI is going to be affecting their day-to-day. This is someone in India. So... you should also check out AI 2041. It's also a very interesting book. And deep learning breakthroughs now are putting us on the edge of automation, which is going to affect all the aspects of our economy. A lot of the tools that we use, a lot of the apps that we use, a lot of the things that we use, especially on the internet, are going to be changed by AI. And in my opinion, AI is going to be kind of... I don't want to say it's going to be bigger than the internet, but it's going to be, in terms of the impact of pre-AI and post-AI, it will make the internet seem like it was like the way the internet made landlines seem, like, in terms of basic infrastructure. The internet that we have now is going to seem just like basic infrastructure, And then AI is going to seem like the new level of advancement in human technology. This is because AI will help you create everything. It'll help you create new stories, new movies. In the future, probably entire movies are going to be created using artificial intelligence. Books will be created using artificial intelligence. I don't know, artworks, pretty much even scientific discoveries, accounting, prediction, habit tracking and business is going to be done through AI. Now, there is division and anxiety about whether AI is good or bad. And I personally think this is a bit it's okay it's possible that AI will have some bad use cases or something like that. But AI, and this is how I want you to see AI is a tool. So the same way you have WhatsApp, the same way you have Photoshop, the same way you can use a pencil to make a drawing, AI is going to be a tool that you as an artist can use to express yourself. It's just that it's going to take away a lot of the laborious stuff that people had to do. If you had to, hire 10 billion people for you to be able to make a single movie, now you'll be able to press a button or write a few prompts and you'll be able to generate that same movie. It doesn't, okay, a lot of people will have been removed from that step, but now we will have more movies and you'll have better movies. And just because it's an AI that did it, it doesn't mean that it's any better or any worse, because a lot of these things, even the idea of AI itself is a human creation. Human beings created AI. So AI is a tool. It's not something that you should fear. It's not something that's gonna take over, I don't know what. If you are in a position to learn about these tools and use them to your advantage, that's the best position you can put yourself in, instead of feeling like AI is going to somehow take away from you. It's going to add to your life. It's going to add more hours into your life because you won't have to do certain tasks. It's going to add more creativity in your life because it'll give you many more options for the kinds of creativity that you can make. AI won't just be making art for itself. It's human beings who are going to be taking AI and using it to create new ideas, to create new tools, to create new infrastructure, to create new art and media. Before it was much more, it's right now it's much more difficult for you to make a movie, for you to make a song. What if AI made it easy? Like you can make a whole song in 2 minutes, and that song can be enjoyed by millions of people. Is that not a better world to live in? And that's the positive upside of AI. Just like the internet, there is possibly going to be a bad side of it. Like the in jobs which have to do with automation, like factories and things like that, people might lose jobs, but this is a trend that has been happening all throughout history. Through the Industrial Revolution, like people lose jobs, even the information age. Like you basically, we shouldn't hope that that AI stops. We should hope that AI gets better and better and better, because it's going to free up more time for humanity to move on to the next level. We don't know what the next level is, but it's going to involve much more creativity. Right now, there's a lot more people who are making money, making a living off of doing things with which they actually enjoy naturally that they could not have done before. In the 1930s, the only ways for you to make money would have been to work in a factory, and that's drudgery and slavery pretty much. Like right now, there's you can call employment slavery as well, but there's also many more YouTubers, there's many more musicians, there's many more artists, there's many more people just doing weird things which they are interested in that they could never had a chance to do it before. And a lot of that is because of technology. Technology is what is allowing me to also to make something like a podcast. Before, and this is a quote from Naval Ravikant, if I wanted to speak to 100 people, I would have had to go and, I don't know, hire a room and invite 100 people to come in. But now, because of technology, it's now possible for me to just record this and put it up online, and 100 people can come and see it, 1,000 people and more even. So AI is going to make your life much better. It's going to be a tremendous and profound improvement, and I can already see some of the results. If you look at something like DALL-E, if you look at something like GPT-3, if you look at basically what OpenAI is doing, if you look at what Google is doing, if you look at some of these other companies, what they're able to do with AI, it's very mind-blowing and lives are going to be amazing. So this division and anxiety about whether AI is good or bad, it's a bit misplaced. And I think if you want to be ahead of the curve, if you want to be ahead of everyone else, don't look at AI as a negative thing. Start looking at AI as a positive thing and start learning about it. Start learning how which tools exist and how you can use them. So So that being said, we are on the verge of an AI economy where a lot of the things we're doing are going to be automated. We're not exactly there yet, but we're very, very close. I can feel it. Probably in the next 10 or 20 years, the world will be completely different and it'll be completely AI-based. A lot of the things we do normally are going to be done with using AI. But this book called AI Superpowers also focuses a lot on the China versus US relationship in terms of control of this infrastructure and this technology. China has a lot more data because they are this kind of, they have this kind of state system that's set up to observe billions of people, and pretty much no one has any privacy and everything is being monitored constantly. So they have obviously a lot more data than some of the US companies. And in terms of internet AI, China is leading the way currently. I think even in terms of how they implement their keyboards and how they type is much more advanced than what we can find on like in more Western technology. But the US still leads in things like business AI and autonomous AI and things like that. This is a battle that's going to be happening all around the world. But you should be aware that it's also possible for you to play a part in this AI revolution. You can think up AI models. The tools are becoming much easier for you to use. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of this information had already been discovered in the early, basically in the 1950s to the 1980s, and even ongoing right now. It's just that now the resources that we have to implement the AI are becoming much cheaper and more available. And so we're in an age of implementation. All those ideas that the scientists and the researchers were coming up with all those years ago, now is when they're becoming feasible and practical to implement. So we are going to see a few changes. You're going to see that your applications getting more intelligent, your time is going to be saved, and you should definitely look forward to a world where AI exists and learn how to take advantage of it instead of staying behind. It's just the same way as the internet. I'm sure when the internet was starting to become popular, people were worried that it was going to change things. And then, I don't know, people would lose jobs and the computers are taking over. But it made our world much better. And I feel like AI is going to take it to an even other level that right now, a lot of us can't even imagine, but you can see hints of it. Again, you can go to look at DALL-E, look at GPT-3, and go and look at some of the Google cloud infrastructure and what they allow you to do, the kinds of predictions you can make and things like that. And so that's it. Those are the three books I wanted to talk about today that I've been reading. I hope that you have learned some of these interesting ideas. You can check out the books for yourselves, and also you can find other books which you find are interesting and read them and learn from them. And so I hope you learned something, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye-bye.